last time we got formulas for decay rate and different cross sections of scattering. And a common enough situation is when you have two particles in the final state. Well, that's not very common, actually. What you really have is 200 particles in the final state. But back in the good old days, with Thompson's, have you ever seen a picture of, was it Thompson's first particle accelerator? Hold it in the palm of your hand, this little copper thing, you know, with tubes.
You get accelerated. Was it Thompson or Wolfram?
I think it was Thompson.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong.
It's
probably Rutherford. but it was this little copper thing, you know. It was like a cyclotron, but tiny, like this big. You know, now they're wonky.
Just for electrons, right?
I suppose you could do a proton.
Yeah.
But accelerate it, collimate it. Okay, there's an idea that scales. sort of, actually.
It doesn't scale because of the frequency that it's driving. You need to change
the radio frequency. Yeah. Oh well, you change the frequency, but you can produce different frequency.
You change the frequency as a function of radius.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, it depends on the kick you give it too. So, you know how these things work, right? You've got your D's. So, look at from the side, this thing's a little sandwich, right? You've got this hollow thing, and then another hollow thing over there. So, it's hollow inside that. It's like 90% of a Faraday cage. What you do is you put the poles of a magnet here, so you've got a magnetic field going through. So what happens is, if you create a small free charge particle, say it's an electron. Moving in this region. What happens is, because there's a magnetic field up, B cross B with a charge, means it moves in a circle when it's inside that. These are called D's for obvious reasons. You guys know this, right? Have you seen this?
Yeah.
It's a fun story. We'll finish the story. So, then you give it a kick when it crosses the gap between. So, small gap between, you put an electric potential across here, and the thing gets a kick, so that by the time it gets to here, it's moving faster. And since it's moving faster, it takes a bigger radius as it goes around. And now you want to give it another kick, but you want the kick to be in the other direction. So this is where your radio frequency oscillation comes in. You're putting an oscillating voltage on here, and you want to do it so that it oscillates, so it flips fine each time the electron completes one of these half circles. So you want to adjust the amplitude of that kick so that the time it takes to go around here is the same as the time it took to go around there. The amplitude is how big the kick is. So that determines how fast the electron is going.
Right, but the time
is
more of a frequency, isn't it?
Yeah. So, okay, so there's the question. How does the time it takes relate to the radius? Alright, if we keep the magnetic field constant, well, of course we don't have to do that either, but so we need to change that frequency or change the magnetic field. But, okay, so we've got a certain radius here. We've got let's call that a little r and call this a big r. Yeah, let's figure this out. This is fun. Someone's a mechanics problem. There's a mechanics problem. So the magnetic force is QV cross V. This becomes EVV. V velocity. And okay, that's the force, and that's going to be V squared over R because it's a circular motion. So the velocity is going to be EVR over M. So the velocity is proportional to the radius. Well, the distance it has to go is 2 pi R or 2 pi, you know, R. So the time it takes to go that distance is, so the delta T, so it comes to the gap again, is going to be the distance it has to go, 2 pi R, divided by the velocity, and that's 2 pi R over E V R times M. R neatly cancels, 2 pi M over E V is independent of the radius. So we can put our radio frequency signal on there, keep the frequency constant, and by the time it comes back around, bingo, it's oscillated through a half cycle, and it gives the kick in the other direction. Perfect. So we don't have to tune that frequency as this thing accelerates out, which is nice, because that's a lot of fine tuning, in a literal sense, not a logical sense. Okay, well, that's neat. So, the sense in which this cylinder doesn't scale, all right, so, well, the story goes across, you get another kick, and so it keeps going in bigger and bigger circles until it, at some point it's going too fast and it comes out as an energetic beam of a single electron. So you've accelerated, you know, and it just depends how many times it's crossed the gap, how much energy you give it. So each time it picks up an energy EV, so the final energy is the number of crossings times the charge times the V across the gap. And, you know, just you can figure out what that is. So the... Well, it really depends. You know, there's an easier way to get at it. The final energy is a half mv squared, where v is the velocity it has at the full radius of your device. So let's call this the radius of your cyclotron, right? That's what velocity it would have if it were going clear around the outside there. So we have that here. So EV times that R over M. So the final energy is going to be, you know, square up all that. One of the M's called E squared, B squared, R naught squared over an M. There we go. So E and M are just your electron properties, but the things you control are the strength of the magnetic field and the radius of the device. Okay, well, so how big can you make these things? The limiting factor turns out to be the magnet, because you need to create a constant magnetic field across this whole disk. Well, a couple of meters, and that's getting to be a mighty big magnet. You know, that's the size of the biggest one. There's one at Michigan State that I think is about a quarter GeV, about 250 MeV. These things are good for accelerating like heavy nuclei and stuff, you know. There are some, and they use them to make radioactive isotopes for medicine, you know. In fact, you can make a small one that actually uses this medical probe and produce a beam of charged particles to actually, you know, like do damage to a tumor or something like that. Actually, an older friend of mine who was he was in physics at Berkeley, you know, back when, you know, this was state of the art, and he's gone on to develop medical cyclotrons, and you know, they're, you know, you can rotate them around and aim them and stuff, and you know, they're sort of yay big and produce whatever beam of particles that seems to be right for, I don't know what, but there's a lot known about stopping distances of various energies of particles of various types in flesh, and so you can make these things, you know, go in a certain distance and stop. You do a heavy particle with a charge like a proton, it's going to go in and do a lot of damage on the way. You do something like a photon, and it goes through until it's absorbed, and then it, you know, disrupts right where it's absorbed. You know, so things have very definite properties. They're actually pretty well understood.
They inject things and chemicals into the tumor, will like suck up, and then as they react to the photons, they take a lot of time and stuff like that.
Yeah, you can do that too.
But that's not but a photon doesn't get
we don't make photons.
X-rays, right?
Yeah. Although you could, by accelerating this particle and smacking this beam onto some target, and then letting the target produce some energetic photon. I'm not sure what target would do that most efficiently, but you could do it that way. So I think the biggest one, you know, I worked on one that was about 5 feet across, and that one was, I think, about 100 MeV. So to get twice the area, you'd have to go up a factor of square root of 2 in the radius, or go up some in the field, or, you know, some combination. So, you know, some moderate enhancement. But, you know, you don't want to build a magnet the size of this room. You know, that's a lot of copper.
Why can't you just create a lattice of magnets?
Well, this is what happens. Okay, this is the invention of the synchrotron. Right? What you do is, instead of, you know, having this huge constant magnetic field, what you do is you have a bunch of magnets in a circle like this, and you know, you put a delta V across the gap again, and what happens is, okay, so your beam comes in, you produce a magnetic field, say, into the board here. So, you know, B cross D makes it curve a little, and then you give it a bump, but after you give it a bump, you have to increase the magnetic field here. So instead of not necessarily drawing that very well, but instead of having a constant magnetic field and letting the radius change, you hold a fixed radius, these days approximately 27 kilometers circumference, and you ramp up the magnetic field as you accelerate the particle. So as it gets going faster and faster, you increase the magnetic field up to some maximum. Well, okay, so, you know, what's the maximum? Well, now we're talking about 27 kilometers divided by 2 pi, the radius. And so the amount that it has to turn in these magnets, well, what are these magnets now? These magnets are now about 10 meters long, you know, say the length of this room, you know, rectangular things. So the amount of curvature that occurs in 30 meters out of 27 kilometers is, you know, it's just that tiny bending of the path. All these things are going to be light, you know, they're really trucking. So, I don't know, what energy can we get out? We've got an energy, it's still going to be given by something like this. Let's see if we can come out right here. So, we've got the electron charge. Then we've got E times the magnetic field squared. We've got the radius squared, and we divide by the mass of the particle. So everything that this E is probably some voltage, so that would be the number of electron volts, right? That's an electron charge. So 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 is this E. A magnetic field, okay, these magnets are super cool with liquid helium. Four Kelvin, maybe two or three Kelvin, I'm not sure exactly what they bring it to, but the material of the magnet becomes superconducting, so those magnets don't heat up. So you use much less power than what otherwise will have to be required with all the thermal heating of the magnet. What happened, of course, when was it? A year and a half ago, is that there was some defect in the wiring, I think, that heated up enough that the magnet stopped being superconducting. And suddenly, this wire has all this resistance, heats up, you know, melts everything, and you dump several tons of helium on the floor. It was a real mess. But
Try to play it down too, like, oh, just a small glitch or something, yeah. But it hasn't been back on for
So how long will it take to get it back down? 3 months. That's a big device. That's a lot of cooling. Well, you know, you can get magnetic fields on the order of, what, 10 Tesla maybe? Something like that. So let's say 10 Tesla, so we get a factor of 100 from C. Now the radius, so 27 kilometers divided by 2 pi, that's about 6 and change. So what we're looking at is something on the order of 4 kilometers. So 4,000 meters is 15 million when we square it. When we divide by the mass, what's the mass of a proton in, what do we get, kilograms?
10 to the minus 27.
10 to the minus 27 kilograms, right? Okay, so let's see, what does all that work out to? We've got, sometimes there's that, let's see, that's about 25 times 10 to the 8 times, then these two give 10 to the... 8.
Oh, right, charge.
So that's 2.5 times 10 to the 17. That's too big,
right? Why not? What's the electron? What do we electron now?
Do you square
charges?
No. What I want, I'm thinking of this as E times the voltage to get the number of electron volts. So, but I think I'm coming out too big here. What do we expect? It's a tetrahedron, right? So that's 10 to the 12, 7 times 10 to the 12, so let's call it 10 to the 13th. So let's suppose we only get one Tesla. That makes one of these smaller, that's 10 to the 15th. We're still off by a factor of 100.
At what point in this do you have to get relativistic?
Long ago.
Okay. Okay. This is just the order.
Yeah. So
magnitude.
Yeah, so maybe there's a gamma in there. So maybe D was right, but we needed to that could easily be 1,000 or 10,000. So half mv squared is not relevant here. Okay, good, thank you. So that's probably just about right, because you know, when we're at a TeV, that's 10 to the 12 electron volts, or well, that's 1,000. That's 1,000 GeV. The mass of the proton is about a GeV. So the energy, the energy divided by the mass, that m gamma over m is gamma, is about equal to 10 to the third factor of 1,000. So the gamma or a gamma squared, and you know, this would work out right. I'm sure this works out right. They probably did this calculation carefully when they said that thing out. Okay.
And linear accelerators work the same way, except that they don't have to have the magnets that can find the beam, but nothing that at the curve of the beam.
They don't, yeah, they don't curve the beam actually until, they do curve it at the very end these days. Linear accelerators, you know, why the difference? Like, if you look at the radiation from an accelerated charge, you find that it depends very strongly on the charge to mass ratio. So, it also depends on the direction of the acceleration. All right, there's a component of radiation due to acceleration in the line of the motion, and there's a different radiation term that depends on the acceleration perpendicular to the line of the acceleration, so circular motion. And that component that is perpendicular to the acceleration, in particular, depends more strongly on the charge to mass ratio. So if you have a small charge to mass ratio, you don't get a whole lot of radiation. So want to accelerate a proton? Hey, go for the LHC. If you want to accelerate an electron, the radiative losses are going to be much greater in a synchrotron. Which is great if you're trying to produce ancillary radiation. You can use this to produce a beam of electromagnetic radiation very nicely. But if you're trying to accelerate the very light charged particles as much as possible, you're much better off accelerating in a straight line. So you build a 2 kilometer long linear accelerator. Well, that is mitigated by the fact that these circular synchrotrons are really good for colliding beams, because if you can accelerate your positive protons by sending them around the line this way, then an antiproton with a minus charge is going to get just the same kick, need just the same changes of magnetic field if you accelerate them the other way. So you can use the same beam line to accelerate protons and antiprotons in opposite directions, and then you just cross the beams. I think those two beam lines are, various configurations happen, but it's well suited for accelerating either kind of particle, and having a lab frame which is the center of mass frame is then immediate, because you've accelerated them both to 4.5 GeV if you collide them head-on. In a linear accelerator, that's not so easy to do. So you accelerate these things down this 2 kilometer line. Now what do you do? Well, what they've done at Stanford is to go ahead and do a little curvy thing. So you accelerate both electrons and positrons parallel to one another down the beam. You need different voltages to accelerate them, but you run them both in parallel, and you peel off one this way, you peel off the other that way. Yeah, you get a lot of radiation as you're going around the corner, like that, but then you get the advantage of not slamming it into a stationary target, which offsets how much you lost with the radiation. So they actually have this sort of bowl-shaped thing, so you send it down 2 kilometers, whip them around the corner, and smash it into one another. So this is a collider, too. Center of mass collider is what I'm after. Particle, antiparticle. So these things don't produce 2-particle final states usually. But the immediate final state, not the final state, as we saw, you know, from the gauge theory, you know, talking about the jet. Okay, you get a UU bar collision. You know, what happens? Well, most immediately, say, a CC bar comes off, something like that. Particle antiparticle pair. Those immediately propagate gluons and other quarks until you get jets. But the immediate interaction at the vertex may well have been a two-particle final state. So, the next section actually is wrong. So let's look at two-particle final states. Any discussion of cyclotrons?
Well, how much energy are we going to lose in the?
Well, a bunch. But you would lose more if you whacked it on a stationary target. Substantially more loss there, just getting the target moving at the half the speed the electron was going.
We're going to lose half of it, or less than half, or.
What, to radiation?
Yeah, to is yeah, that Chernikov? Which
less,
kind of radiation is it?
It's not Chernikov because you're essentially in a vacuum here, but anytime you accelerate a charge, it's going to radiate. Classically, it's a continuous process. Quantum field theoretically, it's, you know, probability alpha that, you know, an electron. All right, an electron can emit a photon. Well, what's required to do that is conservation of momentum. So you need, like, a nearby atom or, how about a magnetic field through here that's making this thing turn? So yeah, how does it turn? It radiates.
Oh, okay. Right.
Interesting. So so when you accelerate charges, you get real radiation, not the virtual, so you get lots of photons coming off. Percentage of the loss of the energy, I don't know offhand.
But it's proportional to the energy that you have.
Yeah. It's some fraction, but I don't know what. Some of the flak sites, I bet they have you know, public information on that kind of thing that's readily accessible. Cyclotrons, synchrotrons, all these particle accelerators tend to have really nice websites. Talk to people that are, you know, and all
waiting a year to finish their PhD.
Well, not that
much.
These places depend for their continued existence on public support. These are national labs, almost invariably. Yeah, invariably. So they put a lot of effort into public awareness of what they're doing. So you go to these websites or you just drop in and say, hey, can I look at your stuff? And they say, yeah, sure, come on, here's the tour. So, you know, they're very good at letting people know what they're doing there. And it can be fun to drop in and visit any of these accelerators. You can. Right? You know, you're in the neighborhood and drop in, see it, you get a good tour. So, let's look at first. Is that all the questions?
So, you need like two different magnets going?
For the linear?
Right.
Yeah, you're going to need two sets of accelerators.
Right.
Well, once you've got the mean line all set up and you worry about earthquakes, now you're putting in another line. Merely the problem the first one was. You've already established the right of way and you've got your tunnels in place and, you know, all of the infrastructure is there. So running a second beam line through is comparatively minor. Okay.
Imagine if an earthquake hit the LAC.
Don't even mention it.
Yeah, seriously.
They did choose, the Alster and Old Mountain Range, try to do these in stable places. You know, that's something I wondered with global warming. Okay, so, you know, the Earth warms up, and polar ice caps melt and redistribute a huge amount of weight. The oceans rise, now they're heavier, now they push higher. That's going to affect the tectonic plates. So earthquakes could be caused by global warming.
It's all over.
Except for the ocean.
I wonder how much, what effect. I mean, people say, like, oceans are going to rise a couple meters.
Yeah.
Which, you know, over an ocean where that's like 2 meters deep in a lot of, or 2 miles deep in a lot of places.
You know, what's the math of 3 inches of water over the entire ocean?
Right.
You know, that's a huge mass that's been shifted on the crust of the earth. And, you know, that's not going to go unnoticed by the crust.
Right.
I don't know if anybody's looked much at the effect of that, but, you know, there's got to be an effect of that. Let's see. Yeah, it's really what northern Canada and Greenland and Siberia and the Antarctic, where the ice is sitting on the land, where, you know, we're going to get the biggest shifts in mass. Those are the things that raise the level. The Arctic is just floating ice, so it's not going to change the level.
That's true.
But there's an awful lot of ice. The ice is a mile deep on Greenland, and it's a big island. It's huge. No, and then the Antarctic is the biggest. So there's a lot of ice there. If it gets warm enough to melt it, we'll notice. Anybody?
Oh, yes.
Okay, let's go for this. All right, so we've got this phase-based volume element, V2, I think. Yeah. Okay, so we have our 2 pi to the 4th and our del 4 of... now we're looking at its K. So we've got a particle sitting here, and it's going to split into two, probably a particle-antiparticle pair that goes flying off. Let's see. Well, it depends what it is that decays. You know, this applies equally well to a radioactive nucleus. You know, all the scattering dynamics certainly applies in that kind of case. But, you know, we might be more interested here in the case of, say, a free neutron. Say, right, in an average of something like 11.3 minutes, whatever it is, a free neutron decays into a proton and an electron and a neutrino. Right? That's what you expect, right? You've got this neutron. Well, what's a neutron? It's an up and two down quarks. And, all right, we know that that likes to flip to an up, up, down. The proton's got lower mass, so the we'll see the phase space is bigger. But what's it going to go into? You know, given what we know about gate theory, you know, what is this? Well, two of the particles, a U and a D, don't change at all, so they're just going to go along for the ride. So there's a U and a D, and this is a D, and we want it to become a U. What does it have to do that?
It's a W particle. Is that right? No.
Yeah, exactly. It's a weak decay. So what you get, I forget the symbol for a W. Let's do it this way. This is going to be a W, and, all right, D has a charge minus a third, U has a charge plus two-thirds, so it better be a W minus to conserve charge. What happens to that W minus? They're not stable either.
It decays, right?
Into what's called?
Electron.
The biggest phase space is the lightest particle.
Electron?
So an electron.
Neutrino.
And an electron anti-neutrino to conserve lepton number. Right, so a lepton and an anti-lepton will conserve lepton number. So we've conserved the charge by spinning off an electron, and we've turned this into a proton. So that's what neutron decay looks like, you know, under the microscope. It was a while before that was realized. There was a thing called the Four-Fermi interaction, I don't know, 50 years ago, where it was thought that you could have a fermion like a neutron, that would decay into a proton and an electron and the antineutrino. Okay, so in that theory, you had a vertex that involved four fermions. It's called the Four-Fermi interaction. Fermi probably had something to do with it. it turns out that that's a very divergent interaction. When you start trying to do the quantum field theory of a straight interaction that involves four fermions all at once, it really doesn't work very well in field theory. You get things terribly divergent. So it was a real advance to understand the weak interaction and realize that what looked like was happening at one point was actually happening at two vertices with the weak interaction. This is a much more convergent calculation. So anyway, if we're looking at a single particle decay, alright, in this case, we'd be looking at the neutron, or say the down quark going to a W and an up quark. That's one particle going into two. So we take our neutron at rest with a mass, or our D at rest with a mass, capital M. Of course, that D at rest, if it's inside a neutron, that's a bound state, and it's doing all kinds of stuff. So there has to be some correction. So maybe we should think of some different decay. Maybe a muon decaying into, an electron and a Z naught. That might be a little cleaner. So we have a free muon will decay in, what's this, about 10 to the minus 11 seconds, right? You guys have probably done that problem, right? Can we see muons that are produced in cosmic rays?
Okay.
Right? You remember this calculation, right? Intro physics, you're probably grading it now, right? So particles strike the upper atmosphere, produce a whole lot of muons. Muon has a half-life of 10 to the minus 11 seconds, so these travel with the speed of light, so they go 10 to the minus 2 meters, right? Wrong. Time dilation. Great example in special relativity. They're traveling near the speed of light, so they get a time dilation factor on their half-life, and a lot of them live all the way to the surface of the Earth, and that's why we put all our particle experiments 2 miles under the surface of the Earth in mines, so they don't have this muon background raining on them all the time. There are lots of muons coming in now. Okay, so the decaying particle, single particle, we're going to choose the rest frame of that particle, and it's going to decay into two particles of P1 and P2. So we have some, let's just draw it sitting here, and we're going to have P1, P2, and notice that this the incoming particle, the four momentum is m and zero, because it's crazy to do this problem in anything but the rest frame of the initial particle. So for P1 and P2, P2 is some m gamma. If these particles are identical, then you're going to have something like 1 and some velocity here, P1 over here would be m gamma 1 and minus b, if they're identical particles, which they don't have to be, but simplifies the result. We'll do the general result. We don't have to take this to be the case. Then, let's see, we have our matrix filament. And then we have this, oh, wait a minute, I was writing the phase space volume, not the matrix element. We've got these integrals over momentum, right? So, he writes it this way. So that accomplishes this discussion nicely. And then we have D3 T1 over 2 pi cubed. And I forget what factors we have E's here. Yeah, we've got a twice E1. And D3, D2 over 2 pi cubed, and twice E2. So that's the phase space volume, and then the decay rate, the gamma for decay rate, is simply a matrix element over twice the energy times d5. So 1 over twice. So this is E of the initial particle, so this is twice m. And then we have the matrix element squared and d5. So that's what we're after. And we've got 4 delta functions. So if we integrate this over all final momenta, right, that's going to take care of 4 of the 6 integrals. Well, actually, we can let the remaining 2 be d phi and d theta, and that just gives us our angular distribution. Now, there's usually not a whole lot to the angular distribution of a decaying particle at rest. Things come out in line and probably equally in any direction. Although, if the particle has spin, if you put it in a magnetic field to, you know, line up the spin, then you can get some correlation. So it depends on the particle. If you know the spin orientation of the initial particle, say you take some, let's see, what could you use to line up the spins? Can you run neutrons through a certain airlock device? No, I think you could manage that. But you know, choose a beam of spin up neutrons and then watch them decay, well, there'd be some preferred direction because you have to conserve angular momentum, and that would have an effect. So what we want to do is integrate over the deltas, and let's see. Yeah. So the deltas are going to fix various things in here, but just integrating over the deltas is something we can probably do in general. Let's see. Can we? Where's my matrix element? Since they're deltas, we might not have to worry about the matrix element. Yeah. So what we want is integral d phi 2 over all but d omega 1, where d omega 1 are the angles corresponding to, say, t1. So what can we just write down? Certainly 2 pi to the fourth we can just write down. Then we can do the integral over t3 of t1 plus t2. So immediately do all three t2 integrals taking out this delta function. So we're left with the integral dt1 magnitude c2 omega 1. Then we've got a 2 pi to the 6th. We've got 4 t1 t2. But now e2 is calculated at p2 equal to minus p1. And we've got a delta of energy. Reminder, let's see. Now, is that everything? So, let's see. There's a bit of a function going on here.
If we introduce the solid angle, do we need to put in a p1 squared?
Yeah. Good. Okay. P1 squared, 4 E1, E2, and the delta. Good. And then this solid angle we're just going to pull out and not integrate. So we need to rewrite this delta function as a delta function in T1. So this is equal to delta of m minus, what's D1? It's the square root of T1 vector magnitude squared. So just our scalar variable T1 squared plus m squared. Then we have E2 is now really the same thing. Because we get this minus T1 squared plus M2 squared, M1 squared. So we have to rewrite that delta function. And that's equal to the sum over the root. And then what do we need? It's 1 over the derivative of the function at the root. Times delta of, what is it? What are the roots of this thing? We better find the roots. So,
yeah.
So what is delta of T1 minus T1 root? Like that. So if we set this thing equal to zero, it's really ugly. Let's square it. So m squared will be t1 squared plus m1 squared. Oh, no, it's not so bad because we have... No, those aren't the same. No. So we have this cross term, t1 squared plus m1 squared, t1 squared plus m2 squared plus t1 squared plus m2 squared. So, bring these to the other side again, minus, if anybody sees me either way, let me know. So we get all this stuff squared. Squared plus m1 squared, t1 squared plus m2 squared. So I suppose we just have to square all that out and see what we get. No real relevant square roots, right? We're just stuck with this.
Yeah.
Double checking on this. There's no point in getting it wrong. Did you get it?
I think you might have forgot a factor of two.
Okay, where?
Way back in the beginning.
Oh, good.
The cross term doesn't have a two in it.
Let's see, the cross term.
M squared, the very first line.
The very first, okay, we'll fix it. Where?
The cross term in the middle there. The P1 squared plus M squared minus should be minus two.
Two of those guys?
Right.
That seems right. Let's see. So, what am I doing? I'm squaring that thing, right? I bring this to the other side and square, so I have a two here. So I have a two here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when I square it, I have a four here. You know, that's better, because these threes look really weird. So, that factor, we multiplied out here, but there should have been a four here, not a four there, and a four here. Oh, this does look much better. So, I got rid of the one quarter here. So now, there's a four there, that's that term. This four P1 to the fourth. Oh, boy, hey. It's linear.
Yay.
All right, much easier. Okay, so we have P1 squared is equal to, let's see, everything that's not a P1 thing with everything that is. So let's bring the P1s to this side. So we have M squared minus M1 squared minus M2 squared over, minus that one, for M1 squared, M2 squared. That's just going to change that into a minus instead of a plus. Then denominator is going to be the sum of those terms. So we have an M squared minus M1 squared minus M2 squared times 4 plus 4 M1 squared plus M2 squared. Good. All right. Oh, that's a lot better. T1 is the radial, it's the magnitude of the momentum, the three momentum. So it's positive. So we get two roots here, but the negative root doesn't give us anything. So there's actually a unique value.
Just get 4m squared.
Yeah. Well, Well, that was easy. So, C1 squared is 1 quarter, then we get an m squared minus 2 m1 squared plus m2 squared plus m1 squared minus m2 squared over m. So, that's m squared, everything's units of m squared. So, okay, it's at least dimensionally correct. You take the square root of that thing, and that's p. Then we just have the one root. So, what were we doing? We were rewriting this delta function. That's a delta function over the roots. And then we need this f prime. So, let's see, this function is that thing, the derivative evaluated at the root.
It's a function of p, right? No,
what's that?
We're saying it's a function of p1?
Yeah, we think of that as a function of p1. So,
okay.
Yeah, all of this stuff is f of p1.
Okay.
So, f of p1 prime is going to be, we get minus a half, and we get 1 over root p1 squared plus m1 squared times 2p1. And then another term like that is going to be p1 over the root of p1 squared plus m2 squared. And then we evaluate that at the square root of that thing. Let's see, these denominators, like p1 squared plus m1 squared, let's see, if we add in an m1 squared here, it kind of combines in, but it's not very pretty. Well, now, wait a minute, let's see. Here's a minus a half m1 squared, and then we're adding an m1 squared, so that's going to become plus an m1 squared. So this is going to be a quarter m squared. So that becomes a plus 2 m1 squared minus m2 squared. That's not so bad. And then this comes along for the ride. Did I do that right? So this denominator becomes the square root of that thing. The denominator of the other term is a plus m2, so it's going to change the sign of this one. So p1 squared plus m2 squared is quarter m squared. Then we get minus this. So it's quadratic in this mass difference. There. Good thing we're integrating over a delta function. Okay, so those denominators, so we have the square root of these things in the denominators, and the square root of that thing in the numerator. So those are, they are what they are. Let's see if we can go to an answer here. We also have these energies in the denominator. Let's see, the two energies are the same, right? That E1 and E2 in the integral we're doing is just going to give us, they're not. E1 is the square root of P1 squared plus M1 squared. E2 is the square root of P1 squared plus M2 squared. So we're back to these ugly denominators. Let's see, also, we need to divide by the absolute value of this f prime. So, delta of m minus e1 minus e2. ends up looking like 1 over the absolute value of this stuff. So that's defined some common denominator here. The tans go away. So the common denominator is going to be T1 times the sum of these guys. And then the numerator is the product of. So we get E1, E2. Then down here we have T1, I mean, let's call that E2 plus E3, E1. So that's 1 over the magnitude of F. Times delta, so let's call this P1 root. So P1 minus P1 root. And there we've rewritten our delta function. Now, our integral d/2 is going to be d2 omega 1 over d/2. And then we have there's P1 on both of these. So we get P1 times E2 plus P1 times E1, so that it's just the P1 comes out. Let me write it that way. P1, E1 plus E2. There we go. So, what is it? The E1, E2 cancel. That's not. Then we're going to have a P1 squared over P1, so we end up with a P1 root over E1 at the root plus E2 at the root. And that's the integral where this is E1 root squared, and this is E2 root squared. So the 1 over the sum of these two, well, the middle term cancels, so that's not actually so bad. Have I done this right? Have I lost anything? There's a 4 somewhere. What did I do with the 4? Is there anything else? Okay, so the sum of these isn't that, oh, but the sum of square roots of those is bad, so, let's see, are those the square of something? Well, aren't they though? That's something squared, isn't it? So, 1/2, let's see, that would be m plus m1 squared minus m2 squared over m1 squared. Oh, well. Okay, so E1r is, let's pull out a 1 over 2m. Squared. Let's see, we want the square root of this. Squared. So it's just this thing. So I don't pull out the square. I pull out this m, and I have m squared plus m1 squared minus m2 squared. E2r is similarly 1 over 2m, and probably a minus sign here. M squared minus m1 squared plus m2 squared. So the denominator, isn't this ridiculous? So the every stuff cancels, and we just get m over 2 here. So this denominator is the sum of Oh. It's just down.
What happened with those?
Let's see. So, yeah, the little M's all cancel. So we just have each of them is M over 2, so we add them and we get M. So 1 over 4 M D 2 omega over 2 pi squared and the P1 R. Where P1R is the square root of that thing. That's sort of like what he got.
So, let's see.
Yeah, that's sort of like what he got.
So can you simplify this?
He pulled out another M. 32 pi squared, let's see. So 4 times 4 is 16 pi squared. Where did he get another 2? Oh, C has half. There's our 32 pi squared. He pulls another N out of that to get rid of the denominator. And he's got an M to the 4th. M1 squared minus M2 squared squared. Oh, that's the last term. Minus 2 M squared. We got it. That's it. Cool. Alright, so good thing we were integrating over his alpha function. Alright. That gives us the differential cross section once we know the matrix element squared. So we can actually compute this stuff. The matrix element squared is now evaluated at P1R, and remember P2 is 3 vector P2 is minus 3 vector P1. And, you know, we have expressions for all the energies and such that might come up in that matrix element. You know, or, let's see, the matrix element might just depend on some coupling constants. And, you know, we were getting fairly simple things like I lambda, you know, right, for that matrix element in the scalar case. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these things sort of end up being pretty simple as boils down to. I mean, there's a simple result, you know, well, order by order, you're going to add more stuff. So, let's see. I probably don't need to write down the whole answer, unless we're going to look at a matrix element. And I think what he does is goes on to the scattering, looking at a scattering cross-section. We've got the same sort of integral to deal with there. But we can work through that. So, yeah, maybe if we'd done the substitution for E sooner, written these things as E, you know, maybe some of this would have been a little simpler. Actually, that's the guy looking at them so bad at this point. Amazing what a factor of 2 will do for you. Okay. Good. So, cross-section? Let me see what he does here. He looks at a couple simple cases. Right. We should mention, so you've got this board. Let me just mention that while we're here. So, if M1 equals M2, this is going to simplify. This, where did our factor go here? What happens is the gamma is going to be, well, let me go ahead and write. And then we have this d omega thing. Well, we've got 1 over 4 m, 1 over 2 pi squared. Then pr is quarter. Oh, we need the square root of this thing. So we get a half. But then M1 equal to M2, that term drops out, so we just have these first. These two are the same, so we get a 4. So it's the square root of big M squared minus 4M squared, 4 little M squared, for that momentum. And then we're left with D cos theta D phi for D omega. So, in particular, we can write the rate per unit, the solid angle. Right. So you look, you have a detector that's this big and 1 meter away from your decaying sample. Right. If it's isotropic, then you know just the total solid angle there times the rest of the decay rate tells you how many particles per second you ought to detect. So. Often, you know, suppose we pass this, manage to align all the spins, and you know, and we're looking along the axis of the spin. You might expect to have mutual symmetry around that direction. So if you take that to be the z-axis along the spin, then you expect no phi dependence, but you could get theta dependence for the decay rate. Something like that's easy to imagine. It depends on the matrix element, which I've got it. So that just completely depends on the interaction. That matrix element could be summed over initial and final spins or not. So if you do know the initial spin, you don't sum over initial spins, you just put in that specification into the matrix element. If you don't measure the final spin, then you sum over them. If you do measure it, then you put in the one you measure. So we'll see examples of that. This would be another special case. If one of them is massless. If one of them is massless, then, it's just you don't have the 4 there. What do you have? Do you have a 2? No, just an m squared over m. So, here, yeah, that's right. If m2 is massless, what happens? So we set M2 to 0. So minus 2M1. But then here we're going to have an M1 squared over M. Where do we factor these things? Is that a perfect square?
I don't think so.
Yeah, it is.
See, which is one of the buttons?
Isn't that? Oh, no, because there's a difference here.
Yeah.
But if M2 is 0, it is.
Oh, right.
Right. If M2 is 0, now this becomes a perfect square. So, if M2 equals 0, G1R is a half, then we have the square root, and then that thing is M minus M1 squared over M quantity squared. Yeah. So we can write that as 1 over 2M. So we take the square root of the squared thing, and then 1 minus M1 squared over M. No. Let's pull out the other one. So here, if we pulled out this m squared, we'd have 1 minus 4m squared over big M squared. Here we have just the 1. So there's just that factor of four difference between the massless and the equal mass. Okay. Let's talk about Mandelstam variables. The next thing is going to be a cross section. Maybe we can get the cross section, but that's probably another delta function integral. And the result looks pretty similar, except that it's got this Mandelstam variable in it. So let's see why we talk about Mandelstam variables. Any question on any of this stuff? We got P1 in and P3 out, so we've got to conserve momentum. So the propagator now is, this is called a T-channel interaction. This is the S-channel. This will be the T-channel. The propagator is just going to be 1 over T plus M squared. And finally, we can have T1 come in, exchange a particle with T2, and we could have T3 going out there and T4 going out here. In which case, this is T1 minus T4, and we have a U-channel interaction. The propagator that we have to integrate over is 1 over U plus M squared. So that's the reason for the Mandelstam variable. And this comes up, you know, if regardless of the propagator, you're going to have this kind of denominator. You may have some gamma matrices up here if it's a germion interaction, QED or something. So the propagator could be something like T flash plus M over some momentum squared plus M squared. Well, you still have that after T or U in the denominator here. So this could be T1 plus T2 or T1 minus T3 or whatever. But the denominator is going to have that test in it. And by the time you work through all the gamma matrix traces on top, you could have S's and T's and U's coming in there too. And it can be useful to express them in terms of that. Make the claim that the sum of these three things is the sum of the squares of the mass of them. That sounds like something we could prove without too much trouble. Shall we try that? Should I leave it for an exercise? That's a good exercise. I think it's much better. You know, that's straight special relativity. Oh, did you have that?
All right.
So, exercise. And I don't know how complicated that gets. Remember, overall conservation momentum, right? So T1 plus T2 has to be equal to T3 plus T4. So you remember that, and then you just manipulate the four vectors, and you should be able to get this without too much trouble. It should be a simple thing. Okay. So let's work in the center of mass. Where, let's see, and then conservation momentum gives us, as I said, T1 plus T2 equals T3 plus T4. And, actually, we get equal and opposite free momentum for the incoming and outgoing particles. So that'll be simple. It's the same situation for the energies that we had before. E1 is going to be the square root of P1 squared plus M squared, and E2 is going to be the square root of P1 squared plus M2 squared. Let's see. So in the center of mass, right, we need the the sigma. What kinds of things come into it? We're going to need cross river cross section point one. T1 is E1 and some three momentum. P2 is going to be E2 and minus that three momentum in the center of mass frame. So P1 plus P2 is four vectors squared. That's F. That's going to be the sum of these, but that's just E1 plus E2 and zero. The square of that is just E1 plus E2 squared. So the center of mass energy is just the square root of the mantle cap variable F. And that's a relativistic invariant. Let's see, so then what happens? We're talking about S channel and P channel stuff. Then, we've also got P3 is some E3 and P3, and P4 is going to be E4 and planets. E3. He just called it. I think he called these P and D prime. Yeah. So let P three vector equal P one and P prime be P three. So we can express it with just a P and a P prime instead of all the subscripts. All right. So that's simpler. Now let's see. We get back energy conservation gives our let's see. Well, what is that? Magnitude of P prime. So he makes a bold claim about the magnitude of P prime. From energy conservation. All right. Let's see if we can get at that. What we know is our E initial is going to be, all right, we've got that. That's going to be the square root of F. E final, all right, has to be the same thing, but how do we write E final? E final is going to be
The delta function we did just a second ago.
Yeah.
If we just put in, instead of the big M,
yeah,
we just put in square root of
N. Yeah.
Then
that's it. Of course, that's right.
So.
Yeah. That's where it came from.
When we had that thing we solved for P.
Right.
P2 squared, yeah. Or P1 squared.
Okay, so yeah, maybe we shouldn't go through that whole calculation. That's probably not really worth the time. Proof left to reader. This invariant integral, how would you look at that? What's I? I was this... P1, P2... Okay, this is that. This M goes to, that's going to be by square root of S, right? Yeah, and that substitution is what we had to do.
Right.
Okay, good. That sounds just right. But then this I is the square root of P1. The 2 squared minus, was it M1 squared, M2 squared? Yeah. Let's see, which particles are these? This is scattering, so we've got these two particles in. That's P1 and P2. We know what those are. Let's be writing it. Right. P1 dot P2 is just going to be P1, E1, E2. Oh, you know, you can do this easier. P1, P2 is going to be a half P1 plus P2 squared minus P1 squared minus P2 squared. Let's write it that way, because this is just P1 plus P2 squared is F, and then P1 squared and P2 squared are just M1 squared and M2 squared. So this term is easily expressed in terms of the masses. It's, except, let's see, you get something simpler out of this. Where do those masses go? Oh, three momentum. That's not so obvious. Except that this turned out to be, what was it, E1, E2 times, what, the square root of E1 minus E2 squared minus the magnitude of the cross product? That's been some of that one we got. But they're collinear, so we drop that. So we just get, this is just the magnitude, E1, E2, of the difference in velocity. So if I divide by, let's see. Oh, we've got the two masses in there. I wanted to write that in terms of the difference in momenta, but the masses. let's see. It's just the magnitude of P. So, you know, here's this point. It's the magnitude of 3 vector P times F. Do we believe that?
Square root of
F. Square root of
P.
Yeah, okay. So we can see, square root of that. Okay. Yeah. So we're going to leave part of that F in there. Not obvious. People get into it, I think. I think it's another great exercise, is what I think. But let's go ahead and bust it. I mean, read the book. These are the kinds of things you should compute if you work your way through a book. So, do that. But let's compute this thing. So, P1 to P2 squared minus M1 squared minus P2 squared. And we know that P1 is some E1 and three momentum P. P2 is an E2 and minus three momentum P. So one thing we can do is just compute. Let's just see what happens. So this is, we want the dot product of those squared. So first the dot product, Lorentz dot product is plus a P squared. And we want that thing squared minus M1 squared and M2 squared. And let's see, the M1 squared and M2 squared, we do have E1 squared is P squared plus M1 squared and E. 2 squared is P squared plus M2 squared. And we're going to try and write this just in terms of P. So we want to get rid of the M. So all the independence we want to put into F. And then we want to end up with a magnitude of P somewhere. Let's just see what happens. So we've got P1 squared, E2 squared, plus twice E1, E2,
to T squared plus C squared squared
minus, and then let's take the product of these guys. We have T squared squared plus T squared M1 squared plus M2 squared plus M1,
Wrong.
I want to rewrite this in terms of E and T.
Right.
So, there's the minus sign. Now, this is E1 squared, E2 squared.
Squared.
Then, what's that? Okay. Then, I'm going to have minus P squared times sum of those squared plus E2 squared. And then we're going to have a plus P squared squared. I did want that because that's going to cancel. So.
You want E2 squared cancel.
Oh, isn't that nice? Yeah. Never mind. Oh, so we're done. Right. This is just E1 squared. That the E1 plus E2 squared gives us that and that and that all times T squared. And that's just the magnitude of T times what we just decided over here was square root of M.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And that brings us to 20 after, so we don't have to do that. Phase-space element again. The phase-space element is, you know, much like the one we just did, you restructure the delta function so you can just do the integral. You don't actually have to integrate anything because it is just a delta function integral, but you do have to find the roots and just do the algebra. So that's exercise two. Derive this for you. So essentially getting 643 now only depends on doing that phase-space integral. And you try that in one help, just ask. But it's much like it did before. You just rewrite that delta function as a delta function over the root of T1 and then see what it all turns into. And we actually did end up managing that with helpful thing from the audience in two boards. So it's not that long. Bright linear distribution. I think this has to do with decay width. Yeah, this gamma thing. The bright linear formula explains the energy peaks you see. And typically, when you look at the energy of decay, the spectrum that you get out of the decay of certain particles and measure the energy of one of the outgoing particles, you get a distribution. Okay, so energy, you get some kind of a peak like that. Well, it's not a Gaussian. It's actually a Lorentzian. This thing ends up looking like something over E minus E naught squared plus a gamma squared. And this is the decay width. That characterizes the width of the distribution. So it gives a nice smooth off. And this fits very well with the kind of energy distribution you see. So you get away from that central energy. There's an energy where the thing likes to decay, and nearby energies are pretty good too. So we'll derive that next time. some approximation, non-resistant.
What is this called, Wigner?
Bright, B-R-E-I-T, and Wigner. Then he does some free body problems and does phase-space integrals there. You might need to work through some of that. Because I have no doubt that he's going to just apply those results to 3D.